The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
From a nightclub at the end of the world, this is Michael C. Rupert, and welcome back to a very special edition of the Lifeboat Hour on Progressive Radio Network. It is Sunday, June 26th, 2011. We are today doing a pre-recorded show that was recorded on Monday, June 20th, with a legendary guest who I've been eager to talk to, and I've really been looking forward to this for a long time. Max Keiser is a TV presenter, he's a radio host, he's an entrepreneur, he's a broadcaster, he's a journalist, he's also absolutely hilariously funny, and he's totally irreverent, and we hope to hear a lot of that today. Max is the inventor of virtual spirit specialist technology, prediction markets, we're going to ask about that, maybe the Hollywood Stock Exchange, and boy, there's food for a comedy routine. Carmen Beck, we'll find out what that is, and Pirate My Film. Max was the presenter of The Oracle with Max Keiser on BBC World News, which aired throughout 2009. Max also presented films for Al Jazeera English and is a blogger for The Huffington Post. Max and his co-host, sidekick, Stacy, they're the host of, I got messages coming in here already, the weekly radio talk show, The Truth About Markets, on Resonance 104.4 FM in London every Saturday night since January 25. Max also is probably best known to followers of CollapseNet, me, and the Lifeboat Hour from his regular Max Keiser reports on RTTV, but he's liable to turn up anywhere. He's been in Greece lately. We're going to talk about that. We're going to ask him a lot of questions because he's had a pretty amazing character arc as well. Max is a former Wall Street broker, and something happened to change him from then to now. And I respect anybody who has it in them to go through those kinds of changes. But I got to say personally, before I bring Max on, that there are times when I get so angry at the insanity, the stupidity, the corruption, the criminality, and all of the other stuff that's going on, that when I need a breath of fresh air and I need to clear my head, I'll just go plug up a Max Keiser report. And what he does for me, I don't know what he does for you guys, is he vents. And he says things that he talks about elephants in the living room or the elephants that are sitting on our chest with amazing clarity and a rapier-like wit. Max Keiser, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Wow, that was a long introduction. Thank you.
You are quite welcome. Okay, what's pissing you off today?
Well, I just got back from Athens, as you mentioned, and this was an amazing experience. We were right there in the square, Constitution Square. We got pelted with tear gas. We got tear gas in our hotel room. We were shooting a film that we're making, a new documentary, and we talked with all the people there that were part of this informal camp they've set up. You know, these cities around the world that are experiencing this global insurrection, whether it's Cairo or Tunis or now in Athens, they set up these camp villages in the center of the town, usually across from the government building, and they are camping out there, and they are protesting all the austerity measures, of course, that are being imposed upon them, and it's happening in cities all over the world. And in Greece right now, it's becoming incredibly interesting. The police themselves are dressing up like provocateurs and beating the local citizens. We have that on tape. And we'll probably be going back there in another couple of weeks. It's really exciting.
I noticed when I was watching some of the speeches that you gave in Greece, and you have a great stage presence, and that really shows, and that's appreciated, that the screen was blacked out as you moved. Was that so it was not to identify anybody else who was participating?
That's my understanding. There's a rule of no video in the square there to protect people's identities. And so whoever took that video, it wasn't, I don't know who took that video, but they did it in such a way, kind of a vertical letterboxing, so you could see my face, and that's about all you could see. I did another presentation the night before in front of a lawyer's guild. These two guys in Athens, Dr. Tobras and a Mr. Newlis, who are waging the very well thought out lawsuit against the government and against the banks that the government colluded with, including Goldman Sachs, for treason, malfeasance, fraud, and market manipulation, and a whole host of charges.
Do you think the suits have a chance?
There's so much legal pressure coming on these banks that eventually one's going to get through, and we should see some bankers going to jail. Remember back in the SNL crisis in the 1980s, under the leadership of Bill Black, who was running for the government, the investigation into the savings and loan crisis, he put 1,500 bankers in jail. So far, we haven't seen any, really, of substance in jail. But I think that somewhere on the global stage, you will start to see bankers being thrown into jail. In Iceland, they're very actively pursuing the bankers who bankrupted that economy. The government had a referendum, and the people voted basically to reject any deals from foreign banks. Now they're looking to prosecute those bankers. So maybe in Iceland we'll see the first major banking arrests and prosecutions. But at some point, the law will catch up to these terrorists, as I call them, financial terrorists.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how angry are the Greek people? And have you been to Iceland or any of these other countries? Can you compare the level of rage and anger in Greece to any other European country you visited?
Well, I've been, to a lot of these countries now. And it's interesting. The level of anger, once it hits, it becomes quite strong. So in Athens right now, there's still a lot of people who are oblivious to what's going on. And then you have people who are throwing rocks and ripping up cobblestones and attacking the parliament building. And there seems to be no middle ground. People are willing to kind of go about their day-to-day existence as they've done for quite some time until they really focus in on what's being talked about here, and then the penny drops and the rage follows. And so once the rage follows and the rage hits, then the people are throwing Molotov cocktails and they are throwing rocks and they are getting their act together to defend themselves against this onslaught of banking terrorists.
Okay, let me ask you this, because you were a broker, and I want to come back to that. I want to cover your own personal character arc, because you have such amazing insights on this. But is putting bankers in jail a first step, a middle step, or an end result that's going to solve problems?
I think that would be the end game for a lot of the problems, because you're taking the guy, you're taking the major crooks offline, basically, and you got to put them in jail. And other than that, if you want to look historically, if you let the situation get too far out of hand, you end up what we had back in 1789 in a reign of terror, mm-hmm. where people simply say, "We've had enough," and they start decapitating folks, and they become indiscriminate.
So I would
at some point, and they just start chopping people's heads indiscriminately.
Yeah, I have written for years of my fears of a reign of terror unless we started venting some of this pressure sooner. But when you talk about putting the bankers in jail, I'm assuming then that implies we're not talking about haircuts, we're talking about shaved heads for all this derivative debt that's on the books?
Well, the debt that's on the book, if you take the case of Greece, for example, first of all, back in 2001 when they joined the euro, this was done really fraudulently with the help of Goldman Sachs. It's very well documented. They cooked the books for Greece, and they hid millions and billions in debt so that they could qualify under the Maastricht Treaty to qualify to enter membership into the euro. And then once they were in the euro, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of debt began to accumulate on their balance sheet from outside bankers and outside forces. And this was going along until 2007, 2008, when the global debt party came to an end, and the music stopped, and there weren't enough chairs for everybody. Mm-hmm. And a country like Ireland and a country like Greece is they're sitting without a chair at the moment, and they're being asked to pay for debts that they, the people, did not incur. The government, in collusion with foreign banks, took on huge levels of debt. Now the people are being asked to accept austerity measures to pay for that debt, and the people are saying, no, we're not going to take austerity measures to pay for Wall Street banks and their crooked deals. And this is the conflict. This is the tension.
Of let's say, Greece and Ireland and Iceland, do you have any hopes that that the Irish will stand up and just say no?
Well, it is interesting. It is interesting to see how different countries are reacting in different ways. And I would include Egypt and Tunisia, along with Ireland and also Greece. And you also have now rumblings in Portugal, Italy, and Spain. Iceland is a unique situation. But I would also include into this mix Madison, Wisconsin, and what's going on there recently with Governor Scott Walker. I put all that together in terms of this global inflection. But of all the cities we just mentioned, Iceland has allowed their economy to collapse and their currency to collapse in the wake of the scandal. Mm-hmm. And now the worst of it is behind them, and their economy is growing again. And it shows you what happens if you just let the chips fall where they may and build from scratch. And this ultimately is what's going to happen to Greece. They'll go back to the drachma. They'll fall out of the eurozone. The economy will collapse, and they'll have 2 or 3 years of gut-wrenching changes. But they'll come out the other side in a place of being able to grow. And this is ultimately what's going to happen. And the longer that they wait, the more painful it's going to be. There's a premium, there's an expediency here, and a premium for expediency. If they were to default on these bonds immediately, the pain would be less. The further they wait to default on the bonds, the more painful it's going to be. Now we see the same bankers at work causing the same kind of financial terrorism, as I call it, in Portugal. They're looking at Spain, and they won't stop because they follow an ideology, a market fundamentalism. They believe they're doing God's work. They're armed with weapons of mass financial destruction, and their goal is annihilation. They're financial terrorists.
So is the fundamental thing holding, let's say, Greece back right now from saying, screw you, we default, we're going to bite the bullet? What is it, psychological pressure that's being used? How is Papandreou and his parliament being coerced into cooperating with the EU and the IMF?
We saw it in 2008. Remember, Hank Paulson went to Congress and said, give us $750 billion or the entire economy is going to collapse.
Right.
And Congress wrote him a check. So they threaten economic collapse. They're holding the country hostage. So Greece is effectively being held hostage by international bankers and Papandreou, the prime minister. The politicians are in bed with the bankers. And so the other part of it is that the media, the mainstream media in Greece, is also in the pocket of the same political people and the same bankers. So there's no real discussion on the mainstream media level of what's really going on. There's one channel in Greece called Contra Channel, which is about 1 year old, that is looking at things from an alternative point of view, and they're getting very, very popular. But other than that, the media is not reporting. Same thing in the United States. The mainstream media in the United States doesn't really report on this stuff. The only guy in the States who's really on top of this would be Matt Taibbi, reporting in the Rolling Stone. Now, he came out recently with an expose in Goldman Sachs again, and then the New York Times felt it was necessary to have their boy, Sorkin's, write a smear piece against Matt Taibbi, and even to make a propaganda movie about how Hank Paulson is a good guy. In a recent HBO film starring Bill Hurt about how, Lloyd Blankfein and the gang saved the world. It's pure propaganda.
Okay, so you have also been clearly on the record for quite a while acknowledging the reality of peak oil. And you've made some great comments, like I'm fond of doing, and my old friend Matthew Simmons was fond of doing, that the Saudis are lying through their teeth when they say they can increase production. But given the fact that there's like a 96% correlation between greenhouse gas emission and GDP growth, how does peak oil now play into the potential of a bankruptcy or default by Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, any of them?
Well, the peak oil story is it's a global story. And you have to understand that the entire oil industry since the 1970s, when the U.S. went on the petrodollar standard, when they went off the gold standard, when Nixon defaulted on his international obligations, closed the gold window, and we started with the era of the petrodollar, and we started an era of global growth driven by cheap oil. At the same time, you also had concurrently a growth in the global credit markets of hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of credit being created to go along with the oil business, because the oil market, the oil business, the oil industry is extremely credit heavy. It takes a lot of credit to go out there and find and drill, process, deliver, and market oil and gas and petrochemicals and that entire industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 2007, 2008, when oil peaked, and by this we mean cheap oil, all of the oil that is readily available using traditional means at a cost that's commensurate with a functioning economy, when that hit its peak, we also had a peak credit. And the primary reason we're in this global financial crash and it's ongoing is because we hit peak credit. Banks are not lending because there's no loans to be made. There's no growth. There's no underlying oil-centric economy to drive both the credit industry and the oil industry, and they're collapsing in a way that you could describe as being coterminous. They're both collapsing: peak credit, peak oil. Triples down to countries like Ireland and Greece, who they're suffering from the fact that there's no scenario out there that you could construct to have them pay off any of these debts based on any growth, because the growth is ultimately tied to oil. And this is an interesting statistic,
yeah,
is that the amount of growth required to pay the global debt, if you look at all the debt around the world and you figure out the growth it would take to fund the necessary business activities and tax revenues and everything else to pay down the current level of debt, there is not enough oil in the ground to power the necessary GDP growth to create the revenue to pay the existing debt level.
So
statistically, mathematically, we know for certain that the debt that is currently tied to the globe, that's a $60 trillion global economy with $600 trillion in derivatives, that debt will not be paid. There's simply not enough oil to sustain the growth to pay the debt.
Right. So this really is crunch time. So any more bailouts are really just adding superficial, deadly weight to distract. I mean, it's a totally misappropriate use of any energy resources that are left to try to pay debt with that, correct?
Well, look at the IMF, for example. The IMF is supposedly bailing out Greece to some degree, but the IMF is bankrupt. The IMF has no money. So what's really going on here? The IMF is effectively using Greece's assets as collateral to arrange for more debt so that they can take over Greece and sell the assets and hope that something will be left over to pay themselves in fees. So this is the same model we saw starting in the 1980s, the leverage buyouts, or the hostile raids of the 1980s, the leverage buyouts. You use the collateral, the company that you're going to acquire, to finance the takeover of that company. Here the IMF is using the collateral of Greece, and there's a lot of collateral there, to arrange the loans to buy Greece and then to sell Greece's assets.
This sounds like a snake eating its own tail. It can't be nutritious. We're at 25 past the hour. You're on the Lifeboat Hour with Michael C. Rupert. That's me and our incredibly special guest tonight, Max Kaiser. You can find him at maxkaiser.com. He also has the Kaiser Report on RTTV. I watch this on a regular basis just as a reality check. So for our musical break tonight in this incredible show with Max Kaiser, what we're going to do is, by request, you guys have all called in. Thank you so much. We're going to play Venice Boardwalk Blues, which we premiered for you. It's a song that that I wrote the lyrics for and recorded in Venice on March 30th, my last day down in Venice, California. The band involved is Karma Auger on drums, who also produced the song at his studio, Ghost Town in Venice, Andreas Geck on bass, and the great Julian Coryell on all the guitars on the track. But on keyboard is the legendary Brian Auger, a keyboard player who is known and respected and loved worldwide. I'm honored that he played on this song for us. But, you know, with what Max and I are talking about tonight, singing the blues always makes you feel better. I hope you enjoy it. Venice Boardwalk Blues. We'll be right back. bottom of the hour. Max, we've got about three, four minutes before station break. You were a broker on Wall Street. How did you get out of that to the absolutely, obviously different state of consciousness that you have now?
Well, in 1990, after being on Wall Street for 7 years at that point, I started my first job out of college was working for as a stockbroker on Wall Street. In 1990, if you recall, there was a bit of a recession. And all of my friends had bought heavily into real estate at that time, and they were all complaining because their real estate was underwater and business was slow and there was a bear market. And I took that opportunity to simply move to Paris, where I stayed for 5 years, kind of just having made a bunch of money on Wall Street in the 80s. I spent my years from year 30 to 35 just living it up in Paris, basically, having not the burden of a huge mortgage weighing me down. So I was sick of hearing the complaining, so I just went to Paris, and I had a fantastic five-year vacation.
And it obviously did wonders for you. We're so glad to see you on this side of the matrix, I can tell you that right now. You travel a lot, and you love, like me, to stick sticks in hornets' nest and poke them around and call people names. Are you paying any prices for that? Is anybody messing with you?
Not at all, because I've accomplished nothing. I've done no damage. No bankers are getting their salaries interrupted. There's
yep.
no bonuses
yep.
being held. Stock
yep.
prices are firm. Nobody in that industry can complain. And so there's no reason for anybody to say, oh, Max Keiser is annoying us in any substantive way. So they don't bother me. They don't know I'm alive. So that's the story. I hear nothing from anybody.
That's exactly the same experience I have. I wrote Crossing the Rubicon. I wrote Confronting Collapse. I did the documentary Collapse. And it's as if mainstream media can't even see us. And I really think that's the case, that they cannot see people like us, because to see us, they would have to acknowledge what we're saying. And I really think that that's starting to play against them now. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour. We got about a minute before a break. Max, this is kind of a loaded question that I was laughing as I thought about how I was going to ask it to you. For me, sometimes the stress of watching what's going on gets to be pretty heavy, and it's quite a load to carry with all the stuff guys like you and I carry around in our heads. What do you do to relieve stress and tension?
Well, in fact, in my case, it's really it's Max and Stacy. So Max and Stacy are equal partners. Stacy Herbert and I are never more than 5 feet apart from each other, 24
that.
Hours a day. It's been that way for 8 years. So
Stacy's great, by the way.
The work that we do, we don't even notice it. Basically, we are in a relationship, and then we take a few minutes out every once in a while to do our TV shows, and then we go back to being in this relationship. So we don't even notice. It's an excuse for us to do something outside of this relationship. Otherwise, we'd be just completely, in each other's face 24 hours a day.
Well, with that, we're at the bottom of the hour. Time for a quick station break. We'll be back with our special guest, Max Keiser, pre-recording the show for June 26th on June 19th, right after this message.
It feels like the ride is head on to the end. Fuel gauge is broken, and your tires won't thin. Your back's up against the wall again. You're the new white trash. You're the new white trash.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the brightest progressive minds in the world.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No. Don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
When everyone, everywhere is running for cover, when bonuses and bailouts are feeding bottom suckers, and your back's up against the wall again, you're the new white trash.
Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour with our special guest, Max Kaiser, Sunday, June 26th, 2011, pre-recorded. Max, what is this Pirate My Film thing?
Well, Pirate My Film is kind of my follow-up to the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which I created in the mid-1990s. And then Pirate My Film is the next big technology startup that I'm now launching on the Internet. And basically, it's a disruptive platform that will challenge the entire copyright industry. And by the copyright industry, I mean the music industry and the recording industry. Because on Pirate My Film, all of the economics are present during the creation and production of a film. And then once it's finished, we distribute it onto the web free of copyright. It's copyright free, using a Creative Commons license. And I am trying to address what I feel is a pernicious and ugly trend in America, which is the encroachment by the copyright industry into the public domain with their perpetual extension of copyright, which is now lifetime plus 70 years. Originally in the Constitution, it was 14 plus 14 years, 28 years. And even that was considered extravagant by Thomas Jefferson, who was against intellectual property laws completely because he believed that the public domain was more important than anyone's temporary monopoly on ideas. And remember, all ideas come from the public domain. There is no such thing as a purely original idea. That is a falsehood. That is a myth. The public domain is where all ideas come from, and it's where all ideas must return. And the fact that it's being co-opted by the copyright cartel, the music and film industry, effectively means that America has been given a collective lobotomy. We can't have access to our own ideas, our birthright of ideas, because they're on some corporate balance sheet. They're too expensive now for anyone to access. And you end up with us, the people, getting only the worst ideas. And so there's no wonder that the aggregate IQ of America is dropping and that the intellectual output and the artifacts of our culture are trash because of this insidious copyright cartel. So Pirate My Film is a way to challenge this model by allowing crowdfunding, that is people putting up $5 or $10 a pop, to fund one of our documentary films, for example. We're going to Spain. So we can raise $5,000 with crowdfunding. And then we make our film down in Madrid, and we release it onto the web copyright free. There's no, and I consider copyright the way I would look at genetically modified seeds or some other toxic additive out there in the environment. It's an ugly environmental catastrophe, copyright. So this is a way to try to compete with that and challenge that.
You can find, listeners, all the information on this at www.piratemyfilm.com. That's the website run by Max and Stacey Herbert. Max has great opinions on this. Just to share my own little experience, I did this documentary, Collapse, with Chris Smith, and I put about a year of work into it.
And of course, with the Hollywood contract, this is no surprise to you. It's not. I'm not quite Art Buchwald, but I had points on back end, and that film was pirated 2 million times. We had trackers tracking all the BitTorrent downloads, and of course, I've never seen a penny from that. But the good news is that I wound up with like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 Facebook friends across 4 or 5 pages, which has paid off in other ways. And we are in a huge transition period, and clearly I think that what you're advocating here is the way things are going to be in the future. But I think a lot of the stuff in this whole behemoth dinosaurian system that seems to be on its last legs now really needs to, I think the system needs to crash a lot further before we can get progress. Max, do you think it's possible to institute any real reforms that make life better? And I'm not talking in terms of money or consumer goods for people, without tearing the whole system down.
No, I don't. I think you need to tear the whole system down.
Yeah,
I mean, I think in the U.S. is beyond repair, and that only an insurrection, only a revolution will be suitable as a way to salvage what can be salvaged and to start all over again, because the U.S. is staring down the barrel of $100 trillion worth of debt. All the unfunded pension liabilities, the unfunded Social Security, the unfunded Medicare and Medicaid, the corporate debt, the personal debt, and the government debt, you add it all up, it's $100 trillion. That's an economy with $14 trillion GDP. That the debt will never be paid, it'll never, ever be paid. And to try to hope and wish that the debt will go away and raise the debt ceiling again to $16 trillion and $20 trillion, it's just causing more food stamp usage, more unemployment, more devastation, more economic blight. And it's great for the 1 or 2% of the population that makes money, like J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan, not only do they rape people with derivatives on one side of the ledger, they're the biggest supplier of food stamps on the other side of the ledger. So they get you coming and going. Now, these two or three major financial terrorist organizations need to be put out of business. And if the government doesn't put them out of business, then it's up to the people to put them. You know, like Rousseau said, you know, 250 years ago or so, if the social contract is broken, the people must revolt.
Yes. Yes. And all of the philosophes, as they were called, I read them all when I was going through college, were clear. And you had guys like Locke and Hobbes and all those guys. And clearly this is a fundamental issue, which you and I may be able to see as a fundamental issue that needs to be addressed. The problem is, do the rest of the 7 billion other inhabitants of this world have any real clear understanding of it, or will they in time? Because my assessment is that this is just going to go until everybody just kind of snaps all at once, and the reign of terror, as you mentioned earlier, is a real scary possibility. How would that play out?
Well, the countries are falling in the order of their economic stress. So in Cairo, Egypt, for example, the price of wheat had gotten extremely high due to the manipulation in the futures markets by these same Wall Street banks.
Mm-hmm.
And this was causing huge problems. And same thing in Tunisia. And this is what precipitated the rioting and the regime change and the revolution. Now, in Greece, we're seeing something similar. You've got the onerous and odious austerity measures on the back end of these fraudulent debt carry from the government to the people. In the U.S., what I look for is the price of gas. The price of gas has been kept artificially cheap for decades. And as it creeps up, that's really the trigger that will cause wide-scale unrest in the U.S. I think my prediction is that once gas gets above $7.50 a gallon, that you'll have wide-scale unrest in the U.S., and it'll become out of control. And there won't be much anyone can do about it at that point except let the chips fall.
And from my perspective, because we have this thing called the bumpy plateau, where prices rise to a certain point, economic activity shuts down, gas prices drop, economic activity tries to start a heartbeat again, and then they go back up again. And it's a question as to what the exact figure, I think, is going to be that breaks the back of the American consumer. But that's probably as good a barometer as anything else there. But we also have big food issues around the world, and you touched on that. Through as you have traveled, are you seeing big blips, big disturbances in food supplies prices?
Sure. Well, just to touch on the supply and demand that you just referred to in the oil and gas market, you know, there is some demand destruction as prices go higher. But getting back to what we were talking about in the first half of the show and peak oil, the availability of oil is shrinking. So that means that these price escalations are achieving permanent higher plateaus, and there's no going back because they're running out of supply. And you do have countries that, for example, China, India, that can leverage their local currencies to continue to buy energy and to sacrifice the U.S. dollar while they're doing that by simply, in the case of China, they remove the peg to the dollar. The purchasing power of the RMB increases at a rate that you could sustain a higher price in oil without it trickling down to the consumers like it would in the U.S. because the U.S. is priced in dollars. It's going to hurt them more than anyone else in the world. So this is why the U.S. is particularly vulnerable to this higher price of gas and oil, and why demand destruction in the U.S. is not going to offset the trend toward much higher prices.
Okay, I totally agree with you on that. I'm sure you've been following Fukushima well. What kind of a wild card do you see the nuclear disaster at Fukushima playing on all this other crap that's totally spun sideways now?
Well, I mean, I would have to ask, you know, you this question, because the so-called hot particles, which are radioactive particles that you can't detect them with a Geiger counter, but they are appearing in the filtration system of cars in the Pacific Northwest of America in quantity. So you've got people in Washington and Oregon now who are being affected with radioactive particles that will that are cancerous. These people are going to be extremely ill in a relatively short period of time. They're being assaulted with radioactive particles coming from Fukushima. Now, why is there no... If I wouldn't live there. I mean, I would move. I would not live in a state that's being bombarded with radioactive particles on a daily basis, and it's getting worse every single day. There's no control over that whatsoever. I would move. So he asked me, why don't people get upset about their government or get upset about higher gas prices? You know, I would ask you, why don't people get upset about the fact that they're being bombarded with radioactive particles every day?
I think that's one of the great questions I have. I just gave a speech recently in Grass Valley called The Birth of Post-Petroleum Human, and I'm arguing we have to have a whole new species, and I think that's a great psychological way to break from the paradigm. But we've had, we meaning collectively, you know, the people of the world, we had all of these horrendous scandals going, pick one, from JFK through, I did a lot of work on savings and loan, that was atrocious, a lot of crimes committed by Resolution Trust Corporation, we had POWs, MIAs, we had Iran-Contra, we had the 2000 election stolen. What does it take to make anybody get this? And I realize that's kind of a rhetorical question, but are you as flabbergasted as I am about what it's going to take to make people pay attention?
Well, throughout those events that you just described, you still had, over the period of those decades, an expansion in credit. Now, to give you an idea of what this has trickled down to in terms of GDP, going back to the post-Nixon, post-1971 period, mm-hmm. It took $1 of debt to create $1 of GDP. Then when we got to this 2007-2008 period, it took $7 to $8 of debt to create $1 of GDP. And so that was an uninterrupted trend throughout the entire past 40 years, where despite all the crimes, the wars, the fraud, the banks were still able to continue to leverage up. And in 2000, the year 2000, they passed the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which gave them the ability to leverage up again. 2004, Alan Greenspan put forward some more deregulatory policies that allowed banks to leverage from on their books 12 to 1 to 30 to 1. And, of course, that meant hedge funds could leverage from 30 to 1 to 60 to 1. So you have Goldman Sachs at that time was leveraged 60 to 1, Deutsche Bank 70 to 1. So that history was a history of more leverage, and that more paper could paper over all the problems. There was always a bull market in the bond market. There was always a way to paper over our problems with more debt and more paper. That ended in 2007. 2007, you had peak credit and peak oil. So this is but I think people still believe that within some short period of time, we'll be able to paper this thing over again. And what's happening is that every day, a few more people realize that that's not the case. So every day, every month, the tide of those coming to the conclusion that this is not just another episode in a multi-decade
right.
trend toward papering over problems, but the actual end of the credit cycle and the oil cycle.
I don't want to lay this on you. It would crush me, but I've been asked the question. I'd like to ask it of you. If you were king of the world, if you had absolute authority right now to implement any changes, have you given any thought to what you would do?
Yes, the answer is quite simple. There is, as we know, the world is run by central banks. The central banks run the world by maintaining interest rates at levels that they feel are commensurate with optimum growth in various countries. Within the matrix of interest rates that they track, follow, and manage includes what's called the margin rate. This is the rate charged to speculators to borrow money to speculate with. If you made me king of the world, I would immediately raise the margin rate by 5 percentage points, which would bankrupt 90% of the speculators in the world without upsetting those people who are borrowing money for legitimate gains.
I'm thinking about that. It's registering. It's sounding pretty simple and straightforward. I'm looking for the buts to that. But how would we make sure that lending was still taking place to people who might actually do something productive with it?
Because you are downsizing the cancerous elements of the financial industry that has pushed out all the folks that want to borrow money to do productive things. People who want to start businesses, people who want to do productive things can't borrow money because all that money is being gobbled up by speculators who have access to virtually infinite amount of money because they pay nothing for it. The margin rate to borrow to commit an act of speculation on Wall Street is zero. And as a result, 50, 60% of the U.S. economy, GDP, is tied to speculation. Mm-hmm. That means you can't have a productive economy. By getting rid of the speculation, by getting rid of the Wall Street banks and engaging in speculation, you're opening the floodgates to the real economy.
Would you keep fiat currency?
Well, when you ask me the question, what I would do, my first answer would be, what can I do given the current situation, making the most straightforward, simplest change within the current framework of what is actually in place?
Mm-hmm.
And I just gave an answer. If you ask me now, would I keep fiat money, you're asking me a different question.
Okay.
How would I design a system from scratch? How would I design something from the grassroots up? And I would have a different answer than what I just gave you. But the answer I just gave you is an answer that Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, and Barack Obama could implement within 24 hours, and it would be a complete game changer, and it in the purview of the Federal Reserve Bank to make these changes, and as we talked about at their Open Market Committee from time to time, and I've talked to people like Jim Rivers about it, who agrees with me, and they can do it. They don't have the will, because they're in the pocket of the speculators.
Okay. And prosecution of so many of these bankers who deserve it, who deserve to be in jail. Iceland, yes, has done, and we've been following the stories of that on the World News Desk at CollapseNet. But in this country, I don't think we have the political or the legal will to undertake anything like that, but I'm hoping that we're kind of hoping that events will push the people and the legal system into a state of reasonableness. Do you think there's much chance of that?
I would point your attention to an old Allen joke that goes like this. Man goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, my brother thinks he's a chicken." The doctor says, "Don't worry, give him these pills." And the guy says, "No, doctor, you don't understand. You need the eggs."
God, we were having some connection difficulties there. Part of Max's last answer cut out. Max, I'm sorry. Could I trouble you to just repeat that joke again? Because I don't think the listeners heard it.
Wow. So this is old Woody Allen joke. He goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, my brother thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "No problem, give me his pills." And the guy says, "No, you don't understand. You need the eggs."
Okay, didn't work again. So we're going to try not to tell the joke and see if we can straighten out the connection issues with Skype here. We're down to our last 10 minutes with Max Kaiser of the Kaiser Report from RTTV at maxkaiser.com. He has a lot of fans and following here on the Lifeboat Hour. Max, what's on your agenda? What's coming up? Where are you planning on stirring the pots next?
Well, we're very excited about the film. On Pirate My Film called Broke Zero. It's a fictional account of 9/11, which I believe people will be very interested to see. It's a story of a broker who makes bets, buys puts in airline stocks while sitting in the Twin Towers. So in effect, he's betting on his own death. And as a result, he makes a lot of money, but he's dead. Now, the reason inspired to write this story is because we know from the 9/11 report that there was $2 million left in an account that nobody collected, who was trading airline puts based trading on inside information, because of course lots of people knew about these events weeks before they happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wrote
so this
a chapter
money
on that.
Is left in the account unclaimed. So this is the story of the guy who made that $2 million but died in the process.
I wrote a chapter on the insider trading on 9/11 and crossing the Rubicon, and that sounds like fun. Do you have any travels coming up? Where are you going next?
Probably Madrid, and we think we may go back to Reykjavik in Iceland to make Money Geyser Part 2. And every time we go to Athens, it just seems like it's a great place to go, and we probably will go back there soon.
I think it's a given now that Greece will default. That's my opinion. I don't think Greece can avoid it, and I think it's stupid to try and print all these additional derivatives debt that are just going to do nothing but smother people. How do you see the dominoes falling after Greece? Because it seems to be a consensus that Greece will act like a Lehman Brothers because of all the leveraging that's done with Greek debt throughout all of the world's banking systems. I don't think people understand how many banks in France, Germany, the United States are holding Greek bonds. How do you see the dominoes falling?
Well, the bondholders in Europe that own Greek debt, they're going to lose a lot of money. But the American Wall Street banks sold them insurance on those bond holdings in the form of credit default swaps.
Right.
They stand to lose much more. $147 billion in cash right off the bottom, or the top, depending on how you look at it. So as Greece defaults, actually the biggest loser will be Wall Street banks.
And so that's why we all need to be paying very close attention. I saw a news story recently that said that President Papandreou of Greece had his sole last wish as to not go down in history as the guy who collapsed the world economy. But I think we are at that precipice. Max, what do you think the immediate fallout would be from that here in the United States or around the world of a Greek default? How would people on the street first experience that?
The big question is really, I will describe to you what the big question is. The fallout from the global collapse, it's either going to go one of two ways. There's either going to be a mad rush into U.S. dollars or a mad rush into gold. And that's kind of the only question left. And there's a lot of people who are betting on the dollar and a lot of people who are betting on gold. But that's really the only thing left to ponder. Other than that, we're talking about a multi-decade economic holocaust.
So, and you and I both know that both gold and silver are outrageously over-leveraged, that we have maybe 40, 50 times, I think it's 42 to 1 from BIS for the amount of paper gold versus gold in reserve. COMEX is basically full of crap with their statement about how much physical silver they have on hand. My read on that is that if this happens, it's possible to see gold go to, you know, 2,000 almost overnight, silver up to $60, $70, $80 that quick as well. Is that the way you see it?
If the world breaks toward gold and silver, then the prices will rise in a very disorderly fashion.
Mm-hmm.
My bet is on gold and silver, because my feeling after having worked with high net worth individuals really the entire for the past 25 years in one capacity or another, I think I have a pretty good appreciation of how they think. And I think when given the opportunity of a sure thing, which gold is, versus the dollar, which has got a lot of problems, that they're gonna decide to go into gold with their remaining wealth. They may only have 10% of the billion or 10 or 20 billion they started with, but that 10% is going to go into gold. There's only 150,000 tons of gold above the surface on planet Earth. It would only fill, you know, the size of a cubic tennis court. There's not much gold out there. So when you try to squeeze a few trillion dollars left into a market that's less than $3 trillion in size, obviously the price has to appreciate quite substantially.
Okay, down to the last 5 minutes of our show today. As I've been watching you, I just want to thank you, and I think I want to speak for all of our listeners who at the Lifeboat Hour, and we had a lot of emails looking forward to your appearance on the show today. Are you aware that there are, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who are cheering when they hear your clarity out there?
No, not really, except in Athens. We get a lot of people on the street who stop us and want to talk to us. But nowhere else is it like this. And I think that the number of people who follow our show, they are outside of the United States. In the United States, we don't really have much of a following at all. And the United States and New York is still the media capital of the world. And, I couldn't get arrested in New York. So as far as my profile in the media world goes, I'm still underground, which is where I prefer to be.
Well, I want to let you know as we wrap up this amazing show, Max Kinzer, that there's a lot of people out here who truly appreciate what you do. I want to thank you so much for joining us on this special pre-recorded segment of the Lifeboat Hour here at the Progressive Radio Network. Max, we wish you all the best. You can find Max Kinzer at the Max Kinzer Report on RT and at MaxKinzer.com. Max, whatever you do, don't stop it, baby. Please keep it up.
Well, thanks. It's been a great treat to be on your show. Hopefully your audience will enjoy it. We can do it again sometime.
Max, keep swinging, buddy. I'm out there, too.
All right, buddy.
All right, thank you. And to everybody, that's a special edition of the Lifeboat Hour for Sunday, June 26th, 2011. We pre-recorded this on Monday before. That's why there were no call-ins. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Lifeboat Hour. Take it easy.